Hello there. Welcome to No Beard Required, the podcast where we chat with amazing people from diverse backgrounds about their journey into tech. In each episode, we'll talk to a different guest about how they got interested in tech, what challenges they faced along the way, what were the wow moments, and what advice they have for anyone who wants to follow in their footsteps. So my guest today is
Hanna Schlander, and I work as a quality catalyst at Devoteam Creative Tech.
When you look back, what was it that you thought, yeah, I really want to do that thing when I grow up?
I actually wanted to become a translator. I did study languages at high school. So I've studied Spanish, French, Latin, and then at university I also took a short course in Chinese. And I did 1 year of Spanish at uni.
I wasn't counting, but that's 6-7 languages?
It's a few. My French teacher always told me I had a hillbilly accent. She actually used that word, it's really rude. But that's because I speak French with a Spanish accent. 1 year she said rural, so that sounded a bit more sophisticated than hillbilly.
It's like a hierarchy of country folk. It's there, you start at the bottom and you're a hillbilly and you work your way up to,
to rural. To rural.
So what was it that attracted you to the idea of speaking lots of different languages?
I don't know. I always found it fun after I started studying Spanish. And then it just felt natural with adding French 2 years after. And when I got to high school, I thought, well, they have Latin, that sounds really cool. currently learning German as well.
But because your husband is German.
Yeah, it would be nice to be able to understand what his family is saying as well. So,
a bit saying more. About you or saying to you?
Both, I guess.
If you consider the languages you have, if we don't take your Swedish, which is your best language?
I would probably still say Spanish, because that's still what I've studied the most. What I left out when I said I did study languages is I also did go to Ecuador for a month for a language trip where I had 6 hours of private lessons a day.
But you could go to Spain to learn Spanish, which is a little bit closer.
I know. The thing is, I'm really not a fan of hot weather.
Why Ecuador?
Well, mainly because of the climate, because I really looked that up with the different alternatives that I had. Mm. Also, they have a very clear accent.
But it's a long way to go. How old were you?
I was 19.
That's a long way to go when you're 19 years old, away from home for the first time.
Yeah. And all on your own as well. And it doesn't help that I'm really scared of flying. So that was interesting. I had a really nice couple next to me on the flight there, but she did the cross sign before we took off, which freaked me out. And the plane was like 8 hours late. And when I got there, my phone wasn't working. There was no phone in the apartment. It was a bit, yeah. It was a rough start. Mm. I had a really nice doorman at the building where I stayed, Oscar. I went down there crying, saying I couldn't call anyone. And then I called home to my parents in the middle of the night for them, saying I want to go home.
Oh no!
but the day after it was fine. Mm. So, but no, I didn't really think too much about it. Also, I know most people going there, they share apartment or living a host family. Mm. But I'm so picky with my food. And I really want to have my sleep schedule. So I lived alone in an apartment. The first week I ate pizza like 6 times, I think. You could actually get a pizza and a Coke for $1. I was like, no, why should I eat something else? But I did try a bit more after that. Mm-hmm.
The aim of all of this was that you would go to university to study languages in general or a specific language?
I mean, the goal was to be a translator between, well, Spanish, English and Swedish. Then I realized that to get into the translator education. So you also had to take 1 year of English at uni. And I'm like, that seems bloody wasteful because I already know English. So that's when I changed my mind.
Was it super disappointing because this is what you'd set your heart on, gone halfway around the world?
I don't know. I mean, a language is always a good thing to have. It's not like it's ever going to look bad on a CV that you speak another language. So I don't think it was completely wasteful.
Mm. You decide to change track.
Yeah.
Where were you drawn towards?
I mean, I've always had a big interest for IT as well. So when I was at high school, I did study languages as like my main thing. But I did also do all of the selectives you could for the different IT courses. So I already had that a bit as well. So I thought, well, that sounds nice. And I settled on the informatics program, partly because I found it was not very, it was quite open. You had quite a lot of electable courses, which I like. So no one's really telling me exactly what to do. I can sort of steer it a bit.
Can you just tell us what informatics means?
Informatics is...
Well, oh dear, that was a heavy sigh.
It's a bit of a tricky thing to describe, really, but it's like everything that has to do with computers, like network or databases, a little bit of programming. So it was touching upon all of the different fields within development. Not testing, though, funnily enough, but it was just like the basics of everything.
So you have a degree in...
informatics, but I think it's called... like it's a philosophical degree as well. So it's called a philosophical degree in informatics. So it sounds really...
It sounds very grand.
Yeah.
But not very descriptive.
Not very descriptive.
Which is the great thing about some degrees is that it could mean anything to anybody.
And that's what I liked about it, because you did touch upon like the mandatory courses were like different parts where it's just basics. And then with electables, you could choose whatever you wanted. So I had one small course in Chinese that I took because that sounded fun. I had one in business English because that made sense. So I took a little bit of everything. My degree from university looks really like, woo, I can't decide what I like to do.
You come out of your degree.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea where you're going, what you want to do?
Well, at first I was like applying for everything like development and... pretty much anything I could find.
Programming jobs.
Yeah. But I did apply for one that said, I think it was a system tester. And I got to go to an interview, so I thought, that sounds cool. So I went there, they had quite a lot of different tests and stuff for it. And yeah, that's how I got into the testing world, which is just by coincidence, but it really was love at first sight because it's a really fun field to be in.
Would you agree that testing to developers is something of a dirty word?
Almost. I mean, the industry is really, well, they tend to give a bit of a, like, developers are better than testers. Like, if you'd hierarchy the different things, people would say that you could move on from a tester to a developer. Like, that would be a promotional step. So sometimes it feels like testers are a bit underrated, actually, or quite often.
What was it about testing that made you fall in love with it then?
Well, it's the fact that you're basically trying to find errors in something. You don't have to create stuff yourself. You don't have to write code, but you get to analyze it and really dig into it and think about, if I do this, what happens? And it's just the whole feeling of trying to figure out, like, have they thought about this? Is this a thing? Does it work like it's intended? What happens if I press multiple things at the same time? And I think, well, for testers, curiosity is a really important thing. You have to be curious in order to be able to test in a good way.
Mm.
And I just found it really fun to actually put yourself in the user's shoes. You might think it's super logical to do things in one way, but if you don't try it out on like users and don't involve them in a good way, you're not really going to get it right. You might make sure that we have good documentation, so we have a process that's documented. because as you say, users are not going to do the same thing every single time. But if you document it, it's a bit more likely that they actually do what they're supposed to do.
Another thing developers don't really enjoy doing.
Oh, really? If you just mention documentation, half of them would run out of the room. If you mention processes, the rest of them will run out.
When you're working in a team, as a developer, you're probably working with other developers and you can share experiences and knowledge.
Yeah.
You're probably the only tester in that project. That's
yeah, and that can be a bit daunting as well, especially in my previous job. I used to work in a waterfall project where we had a whole testing team. Mm-hmm. So then you're thrown out of the comfort zone of being around your own sort of thing to being with developers. I mean, I like developers, it's not like that, but it's different mindsets and it can be a bit clashing as well. Because you don't think the same way. I always say that developers have not easy to get into a new project, but they can start with a small component and work their way up. Mm. But as a tester or a quality catalyst, if you're going to really do a good job with ensuring the quality of the product, you have to understand the whole purpose before you dig down. So you go from the top down. Whereas a developer, you could go from the bottom up and understand, well, everything else as you go. But it's a lot trickier and it's hard to be on your own. When I started as a quality catalyst, I was the only one. So
we've spoken jokingly a little bit about how developers don't like to do testing. But have you ever experienced resentment that the idea that you're coming in to find problems?
As a tester, you really need to learn how to communicate, because although it might be really fun to find bugs, don't go like, yay, I found a bug, to the developer, because that's still something that they've worked on. And it's actually bias that the developer has for their own code as well, called the IKEA effect. So you always have a stronger feeling for something that you've built yourself. And that also goes for code. So you have to consider that the code is something that the developers take really personally. I think it's better, instead of saying that it's wrong, it's better to ask, how is it supposed to act in this scenario? And like have a discussion, not say like, oh, I broke it. It's not working. Like you have to be almost like a really annoying toddler. Like asking why is normally really effective, because well, if someone says that we're going to solve this code in this way, and you're like, why? And then people get to think, because sometimes they haven't really thought through it. So you have to be a bit, always more questioning everything.
So a quality catalyst isn't just at the end of the development cycle.
Exactly. You should always involve quality catalysts and testers as early as you possibly can.
What's the difference between the two?
I think it's a fancy word for it, but anyone within the testing profession would want to be involved as early as possible. And that's like the classic problem that you leave testing to then. Mm. So in the classic waterfall project, you have like a deadline where you have to be done. And if you've implemented something according to shitty requirements, because you didn't let the tester read through them, to verify the requirements is going to be really hard, and it might not even be a good requirement that we have to actually verify to begin with. And then the whole development part is a waste of time. And I mean, quality is not just testing and seeing that things work as they should, it's being part of the discussion, helping out. I think support and onboarding, making sure that that whole process give a good quality impression to your end users. That part is quite important as well, as having documentation and providing a good overall experience. Because to be honest, the quality of the product is not necessarily the same as, well, the product quality of the code is not the same as the quality of the product. Mm. I mean, in my team, we're a DevOps team. We have 24/7 support and we have a lot of different users using our system. It's systems using our system. So it's developers mainly that we talk to. But getting to talk to them, it's important to have a good conversation and to give good support, because that's the overall impression of the product, which is also the quality of it. So quality is not just code quality, it's product quality, which I think is all very often overlooked. Now, it might be easier if you try to push a bit more on that when you try to sell it.
Mm. You spoke a little bit earlier about when you joined DevoTeam Sweden.
Yeah.
You were the only quality catalyst in this side of the company.
Yes. I mean, we're still a really small group. We're 3 going on 4. We're not a lot of people, but we make sure to talk to each other and support each other in every way that we can.
Mm.
However, I also think it's very good to try to find your own pack members almost, but like people within your field that you can talk to. When you're such a minority, you need to have someone that you can bounce ideas with and actually talk testing to without them looking bored and walking away. Because if you're only 2-3 people, it's really hard to take the time to train someone.
Mm.
And it's not normally feasible either. So I think starting at a bigger company with a lot of testers, it might be good to get into the field as well.
Mm.
But yeah, as a junior to get into, because being the only one in your project, you kind of have to stand your ground as well and show that you know what you're talking about. And that's a lot easier when you have a few years in your backpack, so you can actually say, I know what I'm talking about. Because otherwise people are just going to be oh, whatever. I mean, most companies won't even, they'd rather add another developer to the project because then it would be faster to develop things.
Mm.
Rather than think about what a tester would bring to the table that we don't have to redo as much.
Yeah.
And actually develop things of good quality to begin. I'm not saying that developers can't develop things with good quality, but I'm saying that this value that we add to a project that I think is often overlooked and really hard to sell.
Mm.
Going to conferences and actually meeting these people and talking to them regularly has helped me a lot, because it's tough being on your own.
You spoke about conferences and going to conferences and being able to connect with people in the same field.
Yeah.
But you've taken that sort of one step further and you've speak at conferences to other testers. How did that come about?
Oh, yeah, that's also a funny... I mean, I always like to push myself to do things without...
You mean push yourself in terms of challenging yourself
rather
than pushing yourself forward in front of everybody else.
Yeah, good point. Putting myself in situations that I might not be comfortable with, because I think public speaking is really scary. But I got into the mindset of thinking, well, I could at least apply. Then I've done what I can, and if I don't get it, at least I know I tried to. But what I did was, the first conference that I spoke at, or the first time I stood on a big stage, they had this concept where you got to write a postcard or pitching your idea of what you wanted to speak about, and the subject was diversity. So I wrote about what it's like being the only tester in my, in the company, in my team, everything. So being a minority within your work life. And then it was selected. And then I was like, oh shit, I have to actually do this the next day. So I found out Wednesday afternoon, and Thursday morning I had to speak for, I think it was 3 or 4 minutes without any slides or any notes. In the big auditorium at the conference, I'm like, oh, bloody hell. And not tell anyone, because that was a surprise. And it was a gala dinner the same night, so that was interesting.
So it was a sink or swim moment.
It was, yeah. And I was so nervous as well. But it did go really well.
So that fed into a desire to do it more because it went successfully?
Yeah, I thought, why not try to do a proper talk as well?
Mm.
Not just a short, a few minutes.
You get enjoyment from doing it, otherwise you wouldn't do it? Or do you think it's good for your career?
I think both, really. I mean, I'm dead scared beforehand. Like, I'm really anxious before, but when you get up and, on stage and start talking, it goes away. And afterwards, it's such a good adrenaline rush that it makes it worth it. I know that the adrenaline is going to kick in when I start, but beforehand, it's like,
I just need to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, it's like panic and like, oh my God, I don't know what I'm talking about. Because it's scary. Talking in front, especially in front of your peers, where it's like, is someone going to tell me that I'm wrong? You get the imposter syndrome, which of course very common within the speaking, well, public speaking at all. Actually, getting unsure if you know what you're talking about. And that's why I started out, my first conference talk I did, I spoke about my experience going from a waterfall project to a DevOps project, because I thought no one can really tell me that my experience was wrong. So it's always, if you want to start conference talking, start talking about your experience. Normally people find it's more interesting to listen to because it's relatable, and no one can really tell you you're wrong when you're talking about how you experienced something.
Has it ever gone wrong?
Not so far, no. But I do a lot of prep work beforehand as well.
So the key is being prepared and know your stuff.
Yeah, and be able to defend it. And then, I mean, the audience is not out to get you. That's like the most important thing to remember.
Just before you go up on the stage, do you think they're going to find me out and they're just going to start asking questions to see if I know stuff?
Yeah, but it's so easy to get into the mindset that everyone's out to get you and to say that you're wrong. Because as a human, that's just where you go.
You aim to continue doing it?
Yeah, I think so. I really enjoy it. And it's a good way also because, I mean, not that I have a hard time to speak to people at conferences. I'm very extrovert. But people come up to you if you do a talk as well. People will come to you. You know how to look for people, which is nice. Because normally I don't get it that much when I'm working. So once I'm actually at a conference, I'm like, oh yay, people want to know more about this. It's so nice. I normally say it's a sign of a good conference is that I don't have any voice left by then that I go home. And that's normally when I feel like my throat is actually exhausted from talking too much. It's normally a sign that I've had a good time.
Well, hopefully we haven't wasted your voice during this conversation. Hannah, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you. It's been
really
fun.
Really appreciate it. And it was good to get to know you.
Thank you.